Today is Friday, January 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Food prices hit a 10-year high last year. COVID-19 was a major factor.
The input costs, like fertilizer, which are up about 80% from last year. Oil and fuel prices increasing, which means it's more difficult to harvest.
Thousands of U.S. workers call in sick due to COVID. In Los Angeles, 800 first responders were sidelined on Thursday.
These are big numbers.
And the Kazakh president issues shoot-to-kill orders to security forces on protesters angry over soaring fuel prices. We'll have these stories and more next. Kazakhstan's president has authorized shoot-to-kill orders for security forces on protesters whom he calls terrorists. As the violence linked to a popular uprising in Kazakhstan escalates, Russian troops have moved in, responding to the Kazakh president's call for military assistance. Police in the main city Almaty say dozens of people have been killed, and local news reports say the bodies of at least two police officers have been found beheaded. John Spear narrates this report from the VOA Moscow Bureau.
The streets of Kazakhstan on fire. A protest that began over rising gas prices has rapidly deteriorated into an uprising as thousands of civilians demonstrate against the government. The military and police responded with a violent crackdown on protesters. Analysts call this an exceptional uprising, unlike other recent demonstrations that have erupted in former Soviet countries, such as Belarus in 2020.
The Kazakh people are not like the Belarusian people. They are much more energetic and determined, and the country is not comparable. You just have to see that the protests have been in many cities.
In Belarus, the demonstrations were peaceful, and the protesters did not assault government buildings or brandish firearms, as seen in Kazakhstan. But the government's response has been equally swift. Kazakh President Kasym Jomart Tokayev has personally taken the reins of the police and has said he will act harshly against the protesters, whom he has labelled terrorists supported by outside forces that he did not name.
We should consider that those terrorist groups are international, in fact. They've undergone serious drills, and those attacks against Kazakhstan may and should be considered as an act of aggression.
With the situation out of the Kazakh security forces' control, the president has requested Russian military intervention within the terms of the so-called collective security treaties that exist among several former Soviet countries. For observers, this opens a new front for the Kremlin, which already has forces deployed in Armenia, on the border of Ukraine, and in Syria. The crisis also raises new questions about Russia's future strategy in the region.
Kazakhstan has always been a pillar in Russian cooperation in the region, and now it happens that anything is possible.
It's a new scenario, both for Kazakhstan and for Russia, one that analysts warn includes the danger of widening destabilization in the region. For the VOA Moscow Bureau, John Spear, VOA News.
Food prices hit a 10-year high in 2021 worldwide. The United Nations Food Agency says hopes for more stable market conditions this year are slim. World food prices jumped 28% in 2021 to their highest level in a decade. Cullen Hendricks, professor at the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver, tells me he thinks four main factors have created a perfect storm of higher food prices.
This is affecting every point in the food production cycle, from the input costs like fertilizer, which are up about 80% from last year, oil and fuel prices increasing, which means it's more difficult to harvest or more costly to harvest food and ship food, and then also labor shortages and costs related to vacancies, but then also lots of people being out sick or social distancing policies that have been put in place. An otherwise very crowded kind of, food processing context, all of which means that the food prices are getting higher. In addition to that, you have, as I mentioned earlier, the rebounding energy costs. So energy costs are up almost double what they were this time last year. And then, you know, anytime you see rising food prices, typically there are some weather conditions involved as well in major exporting countries. Like large droughts in the United States have caused a big drop in the U.S. wheat crop. There's been drought in Brazil's agricultural heartland. And in addition to that, there's some kind of policy choices by countries like Russia to institute higher export taxes in an attempt to keep more supply in the national market. And I think the final kind of factor that's affecting this at kind of the most macro scale would be the low interest rates. So we have low interest rates in places like the United States and the European Union right now in an attempt to combat sort of the COVID-related massive recessions. But one of the effects of that is to send dollars flooding into commodity markets, food commodities included. So if you take those four factors together, you're looking at a very difficult picture with respect to food prices.
Well, all those things you mentioned, I don't see going away anytime soon. What's the outlook for 2022?
I mean, trying to guess the future right now with the Omicron variant surge is kind of a mug's game. But I do think that the other reports that you've seen are correct, that we're likely to see in continuing higher prices and also some instability in global food markets. And this obviously augurs poorly for addressing global hunger, which shot up during the COVID pandemic and which is extremely troubling from sort of a humanitarian perspective.
In Africa in particular, where COVID seems to be really wreaking havoc on a lot of countries, I know that in Eastern Africa especially, where the droughts, and then you have the widespread devastating floods this past year in places like Sudan and South Sudan.
Right.
How is this going to affect those countries in particular?
Well, even though a lot of the food supply in Africa is still sourced from kind of subsistence farming and local farming, even in places like Sudan and South Sudan, there are pretty significant pass-throughs of global prices into the local markets via the effect of the large food imports that many East African countries have to make in order to meet domestic demand. And, you know, this is really an issue when you're dealing with countries that are, you know, potentially conflict affected, and you already have displaced and very vulnerable populations with inadequate supplies of food. I mean, you're looking at a very, a potential humanitarian tragedy. I mean, the World Food Program has been sounding the alarm on this issue over the past year, and indeed even before that. Troublingly, we're seeing sort of a reversal of the gains that had been made in the previous decade at addressing food insecurity. And so we may be seeing a large-scale food insecurity and even famine conditions in certain places.
That was Colin Hendricks, an economist and professor at the University of Denver. He was speaking with me on Friday. British troops are being deployed to hospitals in London that are struggling to cope with major staff shortages amid the surge in COVID-19 cases fueled by the Omicron variant. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The Ministry of Defence says it's sending some 40 military medics and 160 general duty staff to plug staffing gaps caused by National Health Service personnel who are either ill or self-isolating amid the spike in coronavirus cases in the capital. The military deployment underscores the impact on Britain's health service of the pandemic that affected nearly 180,000 people on Thursday alone in the country, forcing many workers to stay home. While the current military focus is on London, it could spread. Charles de Ledesma, London.
Coronavirus issues are causing disruptions across the United States. AP correspondent Mike Gracia has that story.
The surge of COVID-19 cases has hit police and first responders in Los Angeles hard. More than 800 Los Angeles City police and fire personnel were sidelined as of Thursday, with Mayor Eric Garcetti saying,
"These are big numbers."
In Long Beach, California, Christina Wilkins, who was exposed to someone with the virus and needed a negative test to return to work, was stuck in a long line.
"I've been standing up here for 3 hours now."
Alaska Airlines said Thursday it's cutting its schedule by about 10% for the rest of January due to an unprecedented number of employees calling in sick during the COVID-19 surge. In Chicago, public schools will be closed for a third straight day, with the teachers' union pushing for a return to online instruction and city officials saying no. I'm Mike Gracia.
Public schools are closed again in Chicago today because of fights between the city and teachers' union over COVID-19 safety. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has that report. The U.S. Supreme Court is considering two major Biden administration efforts to increase America's vaccination rate against COVID-19. AP correspondent Mike Hempen has more.
The justices are hearing arguments about whether to allow the administration to enforce a vaccine or testing requirement that applies to large employers and a separate vaccine mandate for most healthcare workers. Legal challenges to the policies from Republican-led states and business groups are in their early stages, but the outcome at the high court will probably determine the fate of vaccine requirements affecting more than 80 million people. Opponents say the vaccine rules will exacerbate labor shortages and be costly to businesses. Mike Hemp in Washington.
Uganda's military has denied allegations that it is holding a prominent Ugandan author who was detained on December 30th. The author's lawyer says he has been tortured and that the military is refusing to release him to hide the evidence. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
Uganda's military has denied allegations that it is holding prominent Ugandan author Kakwenza Rukirabashaija, who was detained on December 30th. The author's lawyer says he has been tortured and that the military is refusing to release him in order to hide the evidence. Halima Athmani reports from Kampala. On Thursday, Eva Basima, wife of award-winning Ugandan author Kakwenza Rukirabashaija, saw an affidavit against three top security officials and Uganda's Attorney General. In her affidavit, Basima contends that since her husband was detained a week ago, she has not been able to speak with him. Armed men arrested the award-winning author at his Kampala home on December 30th after he published comments critical of President Yoweri Museveni's son. The author's lawyer, Aaron Kiza, says Kakwenza's wife was only able to see him on Monday when security personnel took him to his home in Iganga in Eastern Region for a search. On Tuesday, a magistrate ordered Kakwenza to be released without conditions, but police have so far ignored the order. The lawyer says Kakwenza has been tortured while in custody of the Army's Special Forces Command, or SFC, and that's why police are refusing to release him or produce him in court.
On Monday also, the torture is revealed during the search. The man was urinating, blood was vomiting, he was limping, and he was complaining that his buttocks is rotting. That was his complaint. And also revealed is that he has been detained at the SFC Entebbe.
Lieutenant Colonel Ronald Kakurungu, the Army deputy spokesperson, denied the allegations to VOA.
Okay, if the lawyers think that they can take you there. Yeah, also I'm saying that we tortured him. Whoever is saying that he was tortured should go and prove those allegations.
On Twitter, Kakwenza called Museveni's son, Lieutenant General Muhoozi Kainerugaba, obese, drunk, bad-tempered, and a rotting corpse of a future president. Kainerugaba is seen as a possible successor to his long-ruling father in Uganda's 2026 election. There has been growing international concern over Kakwenza's alleged torture and continued detention by security officials. Eamon Gilmore, the EU's Special Representative for Human Rights, said in a tweet Wednesday that he was alarmed by reports of the author's alleged torture and incommunicado detention. Gilmore noted that Kakwenza remained held without trial despite a court order for his unconditional release, urging Ugandan authorities to uphold the rule of law and due process. Lawyer Kiza voiced hope that Kakwenza would appear in court on Monday. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Nigerian police say gunmen killed two local workers at a hydroelectric dam project and abducted three Chinese workers. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Police said in a statement Thursday that the incident occurred on Tuesday afternoon. They say heavily armed gunmen opened fire in broad daylight on Chinese expatriates and local staff working on a hydroelectric transmission project near Gusase village in central Niger State. Niger State Police spokesperson Wasu Abiodun said the police tactical team immediately responded to the attack, exchanged fire with gangs, and rescued four other Chinese nationals and two local workers in the process. The local workers later died in the hospital of gunshot wounds, authorities said. Commissioner of Police in Niger State Monday Bala says authorities are working to rescue the three Chinese abductees.
We have seen the mobilize our officers and men, our intelligence team. They've all been deployed to see how we can rescue the victims. And we are collaborating with all the stakeholders, all the community to give us vital information, that is intelligence as to their movements, so that we can nip in the bud earlier on.
The Chinese embassy in Nigeria has not commented on the incident, but expatriates are often victims of armed attacks like this in a bid to squeeze huge ransoms from their companies. Last year, Niger State witnessed increased attacks by criminal gangs or bandits, including an attack on an Islamic seminary where many young students were kidnapped. In response to mounting pressure, Nigerian authorities recently designated criminal gangs as terrorist organizations. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Carol Van Dam. The world's top tennis player, Novak Djokovic, on Friday thanked his fans via Instagram for their support amid a visa dispute over COVID-19 vaccines that has seen him being detained at a Melbourne hotel ahead of this month's Australia Open. The Serbian champion was granted an exemption from Australia's strict COVID-19 vaccination requirement prior to boarding his flight, but was denied entry upon landing in Melbourne. He now is in a government detention hotel while his appeal against his deportation order goes through the courts. Czech tennis player Renata Voráčková on Friday ended up in the same detention facility. Before arriving in Australia, she had gotten a vaccine exemption, but it also was rejected when she arrived. The coronavirus variant Omicron that is spreading across Europe is driving an urgent need for more testing. In France, where new infections are at record levels, production lines are humming, churning out new COVID tests. The head of a test kit manufacturer in Western France says surging demand has hit like a hurricane. He's hired more workers to make the kits round the clock. Some French labs are running short of the reactive agents needed for PCR tests and are rationing their use. Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen met with Myanmar's military rulers on Friday amid criticism of the first visit by a head of government since the army seized power from an elected government last year. Hun Sen was met by an honor guard and red carpet when arriving on Friday, just as protests by coup opponents erupted in other parts of the country over fears that his visit will provide legitimacy to the ruling junta. The Sudanese Professionals Association, the body leading Sudan's protests, has urged citizens to take part in protests in Khartoum and other cities to demand civilian rule. On Thursday, communications and internet services on mobile phones were disrupted in Khartoum ahead of planned protests. An advisor to military leader Abdel Fattah el-Burhan said armed forces would not allow anyone to plunge Sudan into chaos, labeling the protests a physical, psychological, and mental drain on the country. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi discussed the latest developments in Sudan with Joseph Siegel, director of research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies.
The military has been using this pretext of a crisis and instability as the justification for their coup. However, we should keep in mind the protests in Sudan have been remarkably peaceful and well organized. In fact, all of the reports of violence that we have heard have been of the military against these protesters. So, you know, the bottom line is that the public is fed up with the military-led government. This was true under Bashir, and it's true under Burhan. And the military lacks legitimacy domestically, and it's going to continue to face resistance for as long as it's in power.
Senator Chris Coons, a member of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said Hamdok's resignation cements the October 25th military coup and exposes the intentions of Sudan's military leaders to cling to power and continue to sabotage the country's transition toward democracy. Is that a fair assessment of the latest events in Sudan?
I think it is a fair assessment. And I would go further to say that it was the October 25th coup that laid bare the military's true ambitions to retain power and derail a genuine democratic transition in Sudan. Now, bringing back Hamdok as prime minister was solely a fig leaf to try and obscure the fact that this was a military government. The same holds now when the military is in discussions to bring in another civilian prime minister. You know, we need to be clear that it isn't who is prime minister that matters. It's who's controlling the broader government, who's managing the respective institutions. And, you know, the reality right now is that it's the military junta that is doing that.
The United States, United Kingdom, Norway, and the European Union issued a warning to Sudan's military leaders, calling on them to recommit to the country's democratic transition or risk international action, and warned against the military taking unilateral action to appoint a new prime minister and a cabinet that did not involve a broad range of civilian stakeholders. Would that be enough to deter the Sudanese coup leaders?
Well, this is a very important message from the international community. However, it will need to be reinforced by actions. There will need to continue to be no recognition of the coup leaders as the government, no financial support or debt relief. The junta should be denied access to the sovereign accounts of the Sudanese state. And there should be sanctions on individuals and institutions that are supporting the coup. This includes accountability for the deaths of the protesters since the protests have been going on, as well as investigations into reports that the military has been diverting funds from the central bank into accounts controlled by the military. So from the point of the international community, it's not just a matter of appointing the prime minister. It's a matter of restoring genuinely independent institutions within Sudan and having civilian ministers for the respective government departments that can restore the democratic transition in Sudan.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He was speaking with my colleague Mohammed Al-Shanawi. UN and international agencies are warning that more than 3 weeks after Typhoon Odette struck the Philippines on December 16th, millions of survivors remain in desperate need of emergency assistance. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The typhoon ripped across an enormous area in southern and central Philippines, about the size of Austria, razing thousands of houses and displacing more than 680,000 people. Torrential rains, floods, and fierce winds destroyed hospitals, damaged infrastructure, and knocked out water filtration systems, posing a health hazard for survivors. The United Nations launched an emergency appeal 2 weeks ago for $107 million to provide emergency aid for more than 500,000 of the most vulnerable displaced Filipinos. Since then, says World Food Program Philippines Country Director Brenda Barton, the number of people needing humanitarian aid has jumped from 2 million to 7 million. Speaking from the capital, Manila, she says many areas remain unreachable. Many, she says, still are without telephone communications and electricity.
One out of, I think, 18 municipalities still do not have water. And of course, we're seeing incidents of diarrhea coming up. We've seen children begging on streets. UNFPA, as per the press release we issued, is worried about sex trafficking, gender-based violence, etc. And of course, we as a community are worried about nutrition emergency setting in.
As part of the UN appeal, the World Food Program is asking for $25 million to cover food, logistics, and telecom needs. Barton says the WFP has received only $4.7 million 3 weeks into this crisis.
And the situation, of course, is being worsened now because we have continued rains. We have communities that cannot go into houses or living in evacuation centers. And COVID, just like in other parts of the world, is now, of course, starting to rip through the Philippines with its highly dense population.
Barton says the Philippine government is doing what it can to provide food, shelter, and other life-saving relief to its stricken population. However, she notes support from the international community is required. She warns that without aid, many people will get ill and many will die. She says malnutrition rates among children will continue to rise. If Typhoon Odette remains a forgotten crisis, she says many children will become stunted because of poor nutrition, impairing their growth and development. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That's all we have for you today on International Edition. On behalf of Managing Editor Kate Dawson, producer Nadia Taha, and the entire production team, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Have a great weekend, everyone.